and welcome to this week's Indie Media Radio London Newswire Show. Except that today it isn't the Indie Media Radio London Newswire Show. We're going to bring you some analysis from on the ground in Palestine. We will be speaking with Dr. Jadar Ishak, the director of the Jerusalem Research Institute, about the rapid increase in illegal settlements across the West Bank and the onward march of the apartheid wall. We will also be discussing with Ghassan Adonis apartheid situation and the ghettoisation of Palestinians inside the West Bank. Ghassan Adonis is the co-founder of the International Solidarity Movement and was recently nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize by the Quakers. And finally, we will be speaking with two of the youngest employees of the Palestinian Centre for Rapprochement, who also work at the International Middle East Media Centre. They'll be discussing what it's like to work and grow up inside Palestine. Going to speak with Dr. Jadar Ishak.
Foreigner coming to Palestine, that what's really going on here in Palestine isn't reaching Western ears. We're not getting an accurate description of what's going on, especially with regard to the building of the wall and the rate of settlement expansion. I wonder if you could convey to an English audience the increased settlement expansion and what the wall actually really means for Palestinians on the ground.
Yes. Regarding settlement expansion, the number of settlers in the West Bank now exceeds 460,000 settlers. In 2005 alone, more than 6,000 units were built, which meant that an additional 25,000 people were added to the settlement in the West Bank only in one year. So the settlement expansion is going, and what is happening is that the settlements and the outposts are trying to create clusters or blocks so that they will become large urban areas, large urban settlements, and it will not be isolated as they were before. And the whole purpose is really a land theft or a land grab. The same thing applies to the segregation wall. The wall now, the latest map that appeared on the 30th of April, clearly indicates that only less than 23% of the wall is along the armistice line or the pre-67 borders. The majority of the wall is deep inside the West Bank, and it's going to isolate about 45% of the West Bank between the eastern flank of the segregation wall and the western flank of the segregation wall, and two main corridors that would link the two together. So the picture is becoming clear. And what Israel, what Olmert is trying to get from the Americans, support for his unilateral plan, which will allow him to annex 45% of the West Bank and leaving the Palestinians with 55% of the West Bank.
It's really clear at the moment that the wall is also about imprisoning people in their villages and towns. I mean, it looks to me like the situation here is people will need permission to leave their towns to travel to another town in Palestine. Is that another aim of the wall, to ghettoize people in particular districts?
No, I think this was the old, 3 years ago, this was the intention. But I think if you see the way they are planning the roads, there will be now two types of roads in the Palestinian areas, one only serving the Israelis and the settlers, and the other only serving the Palestinians. So we will not be in Bantustans, but the Bantustans will be linked together through new roads and 500 kilometers of roads and 18 tunnels. And Israel managed to get the Americans to approve funding for terminal and checkpoint management structures to facilitate the mobility of Palestinians to some extent. The ultimate goal is not really putting us in Bantustans or reserves, but the ultimate goal is really the land grab. This means that there will be a very short-term improvement of the mobility of Palestinians. The pressure caused by the growth of population and the restrictions on movement of goods and people, it will, sooner or later, it will explode again. But I think the Israelis are not thinking long term, they are thinking very short term, perhaps thinking that the Palestinians, when they see the conditions so bad, they will voluntarily leave.
I noticed that the Jordan Valley is being divided, and we had a story here at the International Middle East Media Centre that people whose ID cards were not registered in the areas of the Jordan Valley were being deported back to the areas where their cards were registered.
Yes.
Is this common amongst the West Bank?
Yes. Now, these are areas which the Israelis now define as seam zone. And the seam zone will be accessible only to those who are living in the seam zone. So, for example, in the Jordan Valley, the whole Jordan Valley, only those living in the Jordan Valley will be allowed to move in. But no West Banker will be allowed to go there unless they have a special permit. The same thing applies to the Gush Etzion block. Only the residents of the Gush Etzion block would be allowed to enter this seam zone. So it is an administration that was taken in order to de-Palestinize the Jordan Valley and to de-Palestinize the seam zones.
The International Court of Justice declared that the war was illegal.
Yes.
In 2004, the Americans are funding the building of a wall that was ruled illegal.
Very clearly, the IJ said that no government should support Israel in its plan. So the American government should not have supported Israel with any of the checkpoints or segregation, either east or west flanks of the segregation wall. But this is for the Israelis. They consider that the Israeli High Court of Justice has taken a decision which makes the ICJ court, according to Israel, null and void, which is not the case. So there is an international law and there is an Israeli law. Which do you believe?
Well, personally, I think the international law has to be upheld.
Exactly.
I was traveling back from Nablus the other day.
Yes.
And I noticed that it was about a year since I was last in Nablus, and the settlements have expanded along the rural areas, along the hills from Harara.
Yes.
If I was traveling south.
Yes.
And this is just in 1 year, and this is Palestinian land, and these settlements are illegal. What can Palestinians do about this?
Well, you know, we can only ask that the international community upholds their decisions and resolutions that were taken, and that there is no state or country should be above the law. But Israel is ignoring the international legitimacy, and they are building this land, these settlements, and expanding them in these areas that you mentioned in order to create a large corridor that will link the eastern, the Jordan Valley, to the segregation wall through the Ariel block. This is the whole intention. And this is definitely going to cut the West Bank into about five different Bantustans that would be connected through tunnels. But, you know, so there would be two states on the same land, one state serving the Palestinians, which has tunnels and underground roads, and one serving the settlers and the Israeli army, which is above the ground.
Palestinians are not going to be allowed to travel in the open air in their own land. They're going to be forced underground.
That's right.
The environmental cost of these settlements is huge. I mean, Palestine's a beautiful land with a very fragile environment. And these settlements on these beautiful hills are just absolutely shocking. There doesn't seem to be any respect for the environment.
That's absolutely true. And they are disposing of their waste into the landscape, into the Palestinian landscape, open air, open land, and they are bringing all the polluting industries from Israel into these settlements in order to avoid the stringent environmental legislation inside Israel. And this is really an environmental crime.
So Palestine needs some kind of international force to inside Palestine to ensure that the international law is upheld, surely?
We need environment. We need protection. We need somebody to prevent Israel from continuing its aggression against the Palestinian land and the Palestinian people.
Has the Palestinian Authority tried to get that protection in the past?
Yes. Every time we asked for protection, it was said no, because you know, you have to work out it with the Israelis, and the Israelis now are saying there is no Palestinian partner we can talk to, and so we are doing things unilaterally. And Olmert's visit next in 2 weeks' time, American capital, is intended to get the American blessing for his unilateral action plan.
If the Israeli government is breaking international law, repeatedly in terms of human rights, in terms of the environment,
yes.
in terms of building illegally on land that is not Israel's land.
Yes.
If they break law, then surely there needs to be some kind of mandate to ensure that the situation's fair and just.
That's true. Yes.
So what do you think is really going on politically?
Well, I think what applies to the world is totally different to what applies to Israel. And Israel is getting away with all its defiance and total neglect of the UN and the international legitimacy. And this is a cause of discontent that is growing among the Arabs, among the third world countries, and among the Islamic world. And unless this issue is addressed, and there will be one set of standards, one set of ways to deal with defiant countries, with outlaw countries like Israel, then I'm afraid that we are still going to see a continuation and even escalation of the conflict.
Just to make this clear, Israel has a huge army. Israel invades the West Bank daily with this huge army. Palestine doesn't have an army, does it?
No.
So what is Palestine doing in this conflict?
I think the media has a responsibility in this respect, where they consider that, you know, the Palestinians are a match to Israel. No, Israel invades the Palestinian areas and they use excessive force against the Palestinian civilians, who the maximum they have is small light arms. But Israel has all the technology, they can beat the whole Arab nations in no time. I think it's the story of David and Goliath again, you know, and the Palestinians are the David and Israelis are the Goliath, and the world should have a moral responsibility towards the Palestinians.
What do you see as hope for the Palestinian state? Personally, I'm afraid to leave Palestine. I feel at the moment that if I leave Palestine, I'm going to come back and there won't be a Palestine. That's the extent of the escalation of settlements and walls, that wall building that I'm seeing. What hope do you think there is for Palestine?
The hope is that there will be a change in the hearts of the quartet, especially those who would say enough is enough. We cannot allow Israel its agenda and forcing it into the Middle East. And unless this happens very quickly, I am afraid you may be right that very soon there will be Palestinians. You can visit them, the reserves of the West Bank.
So what is being acted upon the Palestinian people is 19th century style colonialism.
Worse, it's dispossessing colonialism. You know, they are not only colonizing the areas, but they are bringing civilians from Israel to replace, to take our land, and they are putting the Palestinians in as little land as possible in reserves.
At the moment, the situation here looks like a really nasty chess game with Palestine almost in checkmate. How can this change?
Very simple. The roadmap talks about international conference. This should happen soon. Israel should now be treated like for its actions. You know, there should be an international campaign to boycott Israel and to bring sanctions against Israel, which is in 2006, just a few days ago, they announced publicly legalized the separation of people based on their nationality. This is the case of the family reunion between Arabs in Israel and the Palestinians. This is a clear apartheid system, and I think the world should say enough is enough.
Thank you very much, Dr. Haq.
Right.
We're going to speak to Ghassan Endonis. Ghassan Endonis was one of the co-founders of the International Solidarity Movement and was recently nominated for a Nobel Prize by the Quakers. The reason I wanted to speak to you was that I really feel that in the West there's not enough clarification of what is really going on in Palestine. The rate of settler expansion, the incredible increase in the war and the land grab isn't really being conveyed accurately to a kind of Western audience. And I wondered if you could convey some of that for an international audience.
You know, what's happening right now is probably a continuity to what have been going on since the beginning, but people, especially in the West, did not have a clue about it. People are busy looking at hot news and political moves, if there is any. But on the ground, I think the, you know, two important things have happened, and very sad ones. One is Gaza is turned into a big prison and being bombarded on a daily basis, and people there are on the edge of starving. The West Bank has shrunk considerably, and the wall has taken a high percentage of the land that was occupied in 1967 and de facto right now annexed into Israel. The Jordan Valley fully have been cut from away from Palestinians. So basically left is very little for people to breathe or be able to move. Take into consideration that movement between places inside the Palestinian occupied territories is very difficult and sometimes impossible due to hundreds of military checkpoints and import closures. With the economic hardship added through the siege caused on Palestinians by some international powers, things are actually on the edge of a disaster.
What can international people do to offer any kind of help? Because it seems that things are this way because the world government wants them this way.
There are issues that are acceptable in terms of relations between nations and states, and there are things that are not acceptable. To start with, it's the first time ever in history that an occupied nation is being sanctioned by major powers that leads the international community. Palestinians can understand if any state or international power is not willing to help them because their government is taking a hardline position and they don't want to establish ties with that government. And I think that will be part of the Palestinian awareness in their future choices. That's acceptable. I mean, people are not angry with that. But, you know, the move in order to prevent others, especially Arab states, from forwarding money to help Palestinians is an act of enmity against Palestinians. And it's like moving from being non-aligned or trying to help or trying to mediate into actually taking a stand against Palestinians and taking actions. And this is not acceptable. And I don't think there is any justification for that to happen, because there is no open conflict between Palestinians and any of those states that are applying the sanctions and preventing aid from arriving to Palestine. The question is, to the benefit of whom is this happening? And why would the national interests or the interests of those states dictate that Palestinians should starve and should be sanctioned? I mean, this is beyond logic, and I believe people have to move against it. I think certain governments have already crossed so many red lines, either in terms of their commitment to democracy and civil and human rights in their own countries, or towards the way nations in developing countries are being treated. And silence on that is not acceptable. And I do believe that if such governments are allowed to do this to Palestinians, it won't stay on those borders. Those governments will cross more and more red lines, and therefore all the achievements that ensured civil liberties and human and nations rights will be attacked to the benefit of the big brother and in the name of security. I think this is fundamentally wrong. I'm talking from an human stand, not actually from the point of view of politics or, you know, who's right and wrong in conflict areas.
What can ordinary people do to help? Is there anything anyone can do? We're faced against such powers. How can ordinary people help?
Ordinary people can help by openly standing in support of Palestinians, and this is not standing in support of any certain government, but this is standing for the collective and individual rights of Palestinians, and apply pressure on their governments in order to change and stop and announcing the state of enmity against Palestinians. People should start actually looking for ways to, you know, to defy the sanctions applied. And I believe it's important for more and more people from Western countries to come and visit the area right now to see for themselves what's happening, because I claim that mass media is almost fully biased. What they reflect does not represent even 10% of reality in what's going on right now.
As somebody that has been thinking about the Palestinian issues for a long time, I was really shocked when I came back and saw the increase in the rate of settlement expansion and witnessed what the wall actually means. The wall has got nothing to do with security, and this just does not get conveyed in Western media at all.
Look, even Israeli officials are admitting publicly that the wall is part of a political plan. And they are naming it now the convergence plan. And it's done on strategic planning. It's not a reaction to any incident here and there. And the whole idea stems out of protecting the purity of Israel from the demographic bomb or the demographic problem, which is turning right now into a legitimate racial statement that's used by many without being checked or revised. This is a total degradation of democratic and human values that's happening. You know, people are sort of silent about it. And I bet you it won't stop at that level. It's sad that people, especially in the West, are not able to see the potential damage to also their lives, not only to the life of people in developing countries or in Palestine, that this new security-based racial democracy is leading them.
What I'm finding really shocking as well is the environmental damage that Israel is wreaking on the actual West Bank, the settlements that are being built, the land. It doesn't show any respect or understanding of the environment.
Unfortunately, this is what settlers did, because they are not indigenous people. They come to exploit, and exploiting nature is a major part of it. Look, in the whole history, it has never been registered that as a strategic plan, state is turning every single Palestinian village and city into a refugee camp without any extension. I mean, right now, look at any Palestinian village, city. The city or the village, its border ends near the last built-up home. There is no more agriculture land. There is no more green areas. You know, people are surrounded with cement blocks, you know, probably 8 meters high. Cement block. You know that those places are not livable beyond a few years, and then it will explode. You know, people won't be able to continue living in such such an environment. And you know, what makes it more sad is the fact that people in the West still look at what's happening and what's called the convergence plan as if it's a part of a peacemaking process, as if it's a step towards solving the problem. Solving the problem means setting Palestinians into reservations. Then, you know, people in the world should really revise what peacemaking is and check carefully what are the ethical moral bases of whatever real politics that people want to implement in this area or any other area.
Do you think that part of the policy for separating Palestine and the villages from its agricultural land is because during the first intifada, people could have an administrative intifada and be self-sufficient because they could feed themselves from their own land? Do you think it's an attempt to prevent that kind of intifada from ever happening again?
I believe it comes out of, first of all, it comes out of greed, because Israel has been always greed to Palestinian land. There was a big competition for more land to be taken, grabbed, and moved from Palestinian hands, Jewish hands. That's traditional. This is part of what they call pioneering Zionism. And so land is an important factor of that fascist way of thinking. That's the first point in that direction. The second point, it also is a continuity to the policy of indirect transfer, and that's fully related to what's been described as the demographic problem or the demographic bomb. You know, creating unlivable conditions for Palestinians that is intensified now, but have been ongoing since the beginning of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories, is also a way to force Palestinians to seek an alternative and leave the place for other places that are livable. So it's a combination of a strategy of expansion and a strategy of transfer, even if done by applying pressure and not by directly loading people into trucks and moving them out of the country by force. And I think this policy of Israel has been systematic all over, have not changed, have sometimes speeded up, have sometimes been slowed down, but it has never been stopped.
Thank you very much, Ghassan. I hope you get the Nobel Peace Prize.
Thank you. I really appreciate your hope.
You gave me a history lesson on the history of Palestine about a year ago, and it was one of the most amazing lessons I've ever had. So thank you.
Oh, thank you for mentioning that. I really appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Media Center, and I have with me Ghassan Benoura, and I have with me Fida Gharib. They're both employees of the International Middle East Media Centre. We're going to be talking to Fida about the Young Advocates Programme, which exists for Palestinian youth in the IMEMC project. And we're going to be talking to Ghassan Benoura about a whole range of local issues. Ghassan has worked in the local television industry and has also been an ambulance driver during the Intifada. So Fida, could you tell us a little bit about the Advocates Project?
Yes, the main objective of the project is equip young Palestinians with skills needed for nonviolent resistance of the Israeli occupation and to be more integrated into the community to be able to serve it.
What kind of nonviolent resistance do you equip the Palestinian youth with?
First, they take a human rights training. Second, they take a communication skill training. Third, English. Fourth, advocacy. The communication training is aimed to equip the trainees with ways and skills for better communication and leadership. The English is the main language of communication for international youth exchange programs, so it's very important for them to speak English very well.
I've come into your class sometimes and I've seen that you have a human rights lawyer that comes in, and I've seen that there's a lot of young people taking this course. And I know that these young people are very active in the town of Beit Zahor. They work as ambulance drivers. They really contribute to the local economy. And I thought it was very exciting to see them acting out role plays. What kind of role plays are you acting out?
For example, yesterday we had a role play about execution.
But then I guess that's part of daily life here. So what was that role play?
Yeah, it was part of the group was against it and part of the group was with it. And do they have the right to execute us every day in the way that they do or they don't? And also in the courts, do they have the right to make an execution judgment on us or not?
There have been a lot of assassinations of wanted people across Palestine recently. Mm-hmm. And it's something I guess that young people have to face. If they suddenly wind up on a list, it's likely they could be shot dead in the street.
Yes. Yesterday it was a very interesting conversation because they immediately jumped to this issue, the assassinations that the Israeli soldiers do every day to all Palestinian people, especially the assassination under the name of wanted, without any evidence if he's wanted or not, he done this work or not, he's a militant or not, is he civilian, is he... That's why it was a very active conversation yesterday between the groups.
What did they say?
Of course, they said normally that Israeli soldiers, they don't have the right to execute anybody. If you want to, I mean, the civilian, the international law is against execution.
What's it like? I mean, because you're a young person as well. What's it like growing up with the sense that your life is constantly in danger and your home is constantly at risk?
First, it was very painful because I remember in the first intifada, I was very little, but I used to think a lot about death. I began to say, but what if I dead now? What if I die now? I don't want to die now. I'm too young to die. Then with the life is going on with the Oslo Agreement, after Oslo Agreement, we began to go out, to go to Israel, wherever, whenever we want, to go with our cars, without a lot of checkpoints. There was a checkpoints, but not as much as the number that it's now. But in this intifada, it's beginning, sadly, I said it, it's beginning normal from our lives. It's painful, but it's normal. We get used to it. We get used to live with it.
So it's normal to live with the threat of death and homelessness?
It shouldn't be, but with each case to stop and cry and start to say, to picture ourselves as we are victims. It's not right. We should go on with our lives.
Regarding as a young person and living and working with the constant alert that you might be shot or killed or whatever, and how is the feeling? My colleagues and I in the ambulance, the fear, the alert sense that fear gives you, that you might get shot at any point, somebody's pointing a gun at you, makes you alert, makes you all the time working 100%, 100% each, all times. Because you know that your life is a threat and you have to do things quickly, efficiently, so you get out of there, you get out of harm's way as fast as you could. So we were obliged to work fast and to assort cases as fast as we could. Also as media. Media is, army hates media. So always the most targeted is young and media and ambulance personnel. So this was the fear factor, let's call it. The fear factor was a normal thing that you live with. It became a normal thing, which is wrong. Fear should be something disgusting, like from our human nature. The fear feeling is the feeling that we don't want to get, you know. You're always looking for safety and for happiness and running away from anger and fear. But here, part of the world, fear became part of our daily life. For example, now, a sound of a bullet will not be so alerting as it used to be. Seeing a tank on the street will not affect us as it used to be. Yeah, we know it's dangerous, but we lost fear, because we know at any turn you take, there is always somebody pointing a gun at you. So if you escape from the tank, there is someone still pointing a gun at you, and you are still trapped in your own city, being subjected to daily arrests, invasions, and extrajudicial killing.
I was traveling through a checkpoint the other day, and there was a school bus ahead of me at the checkpoint, and a young man was being searched by the soldier. The young man was just wearing a shirt, and he had some jeans on, and you could see he had nothing under his shirt. And the soldier was using this opportunity to really feel the man's bottom. He was just really grabbing his buttock, and everyone could see in a long line, and it was just shocking, and it was about humiliation. It was about humiliating this young man in front of his school friends, and I was just absolutely horrified to see that.
There has been like several cases that I documented personally working in media of soldiers forcing young people to, for example, one kid was forced to play his clarinet passing Ramallah checkpoint. Another student from Bir Zeit University were forced to drink his urine to be allowed to pass the checkpoint. Musicians that I know from Bethlehem area, some of them were forced to play music on the checkpoint to be able to pass the checkpoint, to please the soldier to be able to pass the checkpoint. Also, I talked to a lot of people that they mentioned that, yeah, we were sexually harassed by male soldiers on crossing the checkpoint, and that's alerting. Mm. Combining sexuality with authority, and that's a form of inhumane, of combining violence, sexual appetite with the authority.
Mm.
So as if you are raping someone, that's the elements of rape. This is the way I look at rape.
Fida, when you're working with the young people on your project, how do you tell them to assert their rights with the soldiers when they're stopped at a checkpoint?
They can speak to the soldiers that about, it's my right to pass. If I have all the documents needed, it's my right to pass. Also, the thing that makes young people sometimes angry at the checkpoints, Palestinian young people, I mean, that in the first Intifada, soldiers, each group of soldiers has a older man, their commander is older than them, and he is wiser than them. So sometimes this old man try not to be violent, try to let them do the right ways to with the people. But nowadays we can see all the soldiers are very, very young, and most of the times they are drunk, especially at the night times. They are young, they are drunk, and they do whatever to amuse themselves, to try to let the time pass and to humiliate the older people, the Palestinian older people, because they know that the Palestinian older people have their respects in each family. The women have their respects. They treat women, Palestinians treat Palestinian woman in a different way, with respect, with honor. But the Israeli soldiers at checkpoints try to humiliate these two types. And when he see another young man want to pass, or he's good at dress, maybe he's more beautiful than him, I don't know, it's silly to say, but he can do whatever, he can amuse himself by humiliating him in front of his girlfriend, for example, in front of the other girls beside him in the taxi. And for us, as girls, at checkpoints, when they see beautiful girls in the car, or whatever, girls in the car, they just wanted to talk with them, they want to take telephone numbers from the girls, so it's humiliating. It's like, I don't want to give you my phone number, go away. You ask me for something, it's my right to refuse, no? Yes, I can speak with them with somehow polite way for my rights.
What Fida is saying, because, you know, I'm a male and I face problems that maybe she faces double problems of, like, the bother of traveling, and she had to deal with that from the cultural aspect. When I look at the Israeli soldiers, you look at people who are 17, 18, 19, maybe at some checkpoints, with guns, and I swear to you, you could smell marijuana sometimes at night, and you could smell booze. So you end up with undereducated young kids. Teenagers, let's see, with very well-equipped gadgets, drunk or extremely agitated because, you know, the adrenaline and the hormones are pumping. They are teenagers. And then the booze. And then the authority
hyped up that they might be killed by crazy Palestinians.
Yeah, and the brainwashing process, as you mentioned. All of that adds up to an awful situation for ambulance drivers, for university students, especially girls who wants to study a certain, like for example, if somebody wants to study as a doctor, he has to go to Al-Quds University in near Jerusalem, which anybody has to cross a checkpoint to go there. So imagine if you have to go on a daily basis crossing a checkpoint. In Nablus, for example, the residents from the upskirts of Nablus have to cross at least 5 checkpoints a day to arrive to the university. Imagine the level of humiliation and the level of depressing, as Fida was explaining just now. Combine that with the daily things you are living with in your life, in your home. Combining frustration, lack of hope, seeing this form of resistance as the only way out of this situation adds up to creating more violence. According to the international law and UN resolutions, Israeli army shouldn't be in the West Bank, settlements shouldn't be in the West Bank, and the wall is illegal. There is a decision of putting it down. But the problem is, Israel is an outlaw state, mm-hmm. but the problem is it's backed up by a biggest outlaw state. And that's a problem. So if I got the nukes, if I got the army, then I'm above the law. The law is being implemented on countries, the weak countries, while the G8, for example, or the big countries with the nuclear power, they are untouchable. Instead of boycotting the Israeli apartheid, they are boycotting the Palestinian government that was elected by democratic election.
Hamas has kept the peace, whereas Israel hasn't kept the peace. In April, 19 people were killed in shelling and assassinations. There is no peace for Palestinians.
Last year, for example, the Hamas, the Islamic resistance group Hamas, initiated the truce, and they said, "Okay, if army stop, we're gonna stop all of our militant activities." And we're going to reassess the situation when the army responds. 2 days later, they assassinated Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, the spiritual leader of Hamas. So that was the response of the army.
It's like that. They have the right to kill and not to stop killing, assassinating, and we don't. If there is a truce that everybody stop killing everybody, like Ghassan mentioned, it was a truce. You, without any militant activity. And Israel each time do something to make Hamas respond to their acts, like Ghassan said, as if in front of the world they have the right to do anything. But Palestinians, each time Palestinians has to respect and to do whatever they ask to do, and but Israelis no. It's not right. It's not fair.
It's unfair. Were you arrested in 2003?
I worked in this office in an approachment center, and they were working, they stabbed International Solidarity Movement, but I was working with their approachment center, not the international. I was in the same office with the ISM media office. So they came and arrested us. Of course, they thought that all of us are internationalists, so they treat us very carefully, as if they came to arrest one Palestinian, they don't care whatever, they do whatever. But if they came to arrest an international, it's something very different, because the international know that they don't have the right to break in a house, to arrest without permission. They were a little like, they have the caution not to do something wrong, and they picture everything. I noticed very, very, there is a huge difference between arresting an international and arresting Palestinians. Because I was watching my uncles arrested. It wasn't in this way. It was in a very different way. They immediately start violently, they start treat violently, like they grab him, they start to beat him in front of all of us in the house, without saying anything, without mentioning any right, without nothing, just like this. But when they enter the office in 2003, they seems to be very quiet. They have caution not to do something wrong. We are here to arrest you. That's it. They took us to the jeeps. But where we are going? One of the soldiers said, to France. Me and my friend, she was international from America. She said, France, Fida, you never been to France. I said, yeah, it's beautiful to go to France. So we have been taken to Assyon. It's integration. It's so they of course they don't tell anybody where prisoners has been taken, and this is wrong because prisoners should know where they are going. This is first thing, and they integrate with the internationals. They let me go after 6 hours, talking to me, of course, asking me some questions. Do you like Sharon? You don't like Sharon? Why you don't like Sharon? Do you like Yasser Arafat? These stupid questions that, and some other questions, of course, just to take information from me.
You sound like you were very lucky in that arrest.
Yes, I was very lucky. Yes, because if they know from the first beginning that I am Palestinians, they would treat me in a very different way. In a very, very different way, I'm sure of that.
I interviewed a young woman called Asil from Nablus who was arrested when she was 14 years old. And they arrested her and her father. And they locked her in a cell and set dogs on her. So it sounded absolutely horrible.
Yes, I consider myself very lucky.
Some of the methods they are using in interrogations, the best tool the Israeli interrogators are famous for worldwide is the psychological pressure. They know that you are coming from a closed culture, you're coming from an Arab culture, so they will be using that to get pressure on you. They know that women look down sometimes on by our culture, so they would try to humiliate her. The dogs is only the beginning. We have documented cases of people of broken hands, of cutting fingers.
What, cutting fingers off?
Yeah, nails, usually threatening to rape one of your family.
There are many ways of torture. They use many ways. Yeah. I mean, if we want to talk about torture and investigations,
that's
and
a whole
prisons,
story.
It's very... we can talk till tomorrow and we will
not
finish.
And the one that it's significantly illegal is threatening you. If you do not sign this paper, they will bring one of your family members, maybe your wife or your...
Yes,
you're anybody, and they will threaten to rape her in front of your eyes if you do not sign this paper.
Yes, this is a very important something that they began to do. They began to let prisoners sign papers on Hebrew. It's not Arabic, so they don't understand what they are signing for, what they just sign for. And sometimes they let them sign on a white paper. One of my uncles mentioned to me that he had to sign a white paper, and after that they wrote whatever they want on it. So it's very dangerous. Prisoners should not sign it. I don't know what they used to torture them to sign it, but at least they can try not to sign it at first. Of course they try.
I've noticed here in Palestine that young people are incredibly educated and actually incredibly aware of the political situation. I mean, it's impossible not to be. It seems to me that almost all young people here go to university and study, but the world doesn't portray that side of Palestine. The outside world doesn't really convey that. Oh, is it 70% of Palestinian?
Yes, 70% of the Palestinians are educated, and it's sad that the rest of the world don't think that. The rest of the world just see the pictures on TV, the poverty, the very hard occupation, people live in tent. It's not like that. Most of the Palestinian people are educated and they are aware of their political situation. I think they are the most educated people politically and educated in science more than any Arab country. They are very clever And that's why I think if they began to use this method, non-violence and legal things with the Israeli soldiers, Israel will begin to be afraid from these Palestinians.
The point here to mention is, obviously we cannot beat their guns. You know, let's simplify it. They have more guns than we do. Tanks, everything. They are a well-equipped army. They are the third world very equipped army, according to the last statistic. The way to dismantle an army where it cannot function is to make... Israel is a very industrialized state with a really unbalanced in the natural resources. They are poor in the natural resources, basically. So if we make the occupation more costly on them by non-violence means, by cracking down the tools of the occupation, the checkpoints, settlements, wall, by making these tools ineffective, the occupation will be more costly on them. That means more money put into this occupation. And I swear to you, if you make the occupation more costly on them, that's the beginning of cracking down the Israeli apartheid. Of course, this needs a worldwide backup of like boycotting, civil-based obedience in your own cities, in your own... there is Israeli companies that they are marketing products in your cities, in your country. These are the groups to be targeted now. These are the groups to try to close their offices, for example. Boycotting them, stop buying their product. Because, you know, most of the products they produce is mainly from a Palestinian stolen land. Olive oil is they are destroying our oil to sell their oil. It's a business. It's an industrialized occupation. It's a capitalistic occupation.
Well, from my opinion, that Israel has the key of peace, not the Palestinians, because Israel has a powerful force, militant, and they are very, very strong in a militant way. And if they stop acting very violent, if they try to understand, as the Palestinians try to understand them, I think peace will be done. I think so. I think they have the key of peace because they have the strength.
Thank you very much. Today in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Centre, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, May the 16th, 2006. The Israeli army orders a school in Jenin to remove the Palestinian flag. The army detains Palestinian press photographer in Bethlehem. Israeli soldiers invade Al-Qaeda village and beat two children. The Israeli army invades the West Bank city of Nablus. Right-wing Jewish extremists try to set fire to a mosque in Haifa. The army invades Tamun village and the army arrests one resident from Al-Hashmiya village. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. An Israeli army unit stormed the Sabada High School for Boys west of the West Bank city of Jenin and ordered the administration to take down the Palestinian flag on Tuesday morning. Soldiers driving past the school stopped and forced entry. It then ordered the teachers to remove the Palestinian flag, the principal reported. He added that this is not the first time the army have done this. Sometimes they remove the flag themselves when the school is closed. Ahmed Mishir, a photographer for the Palestinian news agency Wafa, was detained by the Israeli army after photographing the new military checkpoint. Mishir was near the entrance of Al-Qaeda village in the West Bank city of Bethlehem when troops decided to confiscate his camera and detain him for an hour, eyewitnesses reported. Local and international journalists have been killed, injured or jailed since the start of this intifada. Tuesday afternoon, Israeli soldiers backed by armoured vehicles invaded the West Bank village of Al-Qaeda west of Bethlehem. The troops broke into Palestinian homes and conducted wide-scale searches, local sources reported. The residents affirmed that the soldiers were violent people in their own homes and beat two youths.
Other soldiers who were deployed around the schools held up several students on their way home and forced them to stand by the wall of their schools with their hands up for over half an hour. No injuries were reported. An Israeli military spokesperson said that their procedures were conducted after Palestinian youths from the area hurled stones at settlers' vehicles crossing the settlers' bypass road near Aikada village. The window of one of the cars was shattered. Another settler vehicle was hit by stones whilst crossing Al-Laban, Al-Sharkeya village close to the West Bank city of Ramallah. No injuries were reported from either incident. The Israeli army invaded the West Bank city of Nablus on Tuesday morning. The Israeli army stormed the city and fired randomly at residents' homes, which caused a case of panic amongst civilians. No arrests were made, but the army was deliberately provoking the stone-throwing youth to clash with them, local sources reported. A group of right-wing Jewish extremists tried to set fire to Al-Manshia Mosque in the city of Haifa late on Monday evening. According to Al-Sheikh Mohammed Mahdi, the head of the Islamic movement in the city, the group of men and women smashed the main door with logs and set it on fire. Residents rushed to the burning mosque in an attempt to extinguish the fire, then called the fire brigades, Mahdi said. Similar groups have attacked this mosque and other Palestinian holy sites previously in Haifa. The Israeli army arrested two youth from Ithna village in Hebron. Yafa Salimi and Khaled Nima were arrested from the village of Ithna in the West Bank city of Hebron Tuesday at dawn. Israeli army invaded the village and searched several homes before arresting the two and taking them to unknown locations. The two are Palestinian Authority police officers in the West Bank city of Bethlehem, local sources reported. The Israeli army invaded the village of Taman, east of the West Bank city of Jenin, Tuesday at dawn. Army jeeps entered the village and troops searched residents' homes and nearby farming lands. No arrests were made, local residents said. Ahmed Hamran was arrested when the Israeli army invaded the village of Al-Hashmiya in the West Bank city of Jenin on Tuesday morning. Soldiers stormed residents' homes and arrested Hamran, who is the local Matheyen of the village. He was on his way to dawn prayers at the local mosque, eyewitnesses reported. And that's just some of the news for today in Palestine. For constant updates, check out the International Middle East Media Centre website, www.imemc.org. As always, thanks for joining us. From Occupy Bethlehem, this is Today in Palestine, brought to you by Penny Quinton and Ghassan Banoura.